The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. While New Hampshire Republicans revel in a bounty of recent and upcoming visits by 2016 presidential hopefuls, an odd silence has blanketed the Democratic primary field, broken only by the sound of an occasional Bernie Sanders house party or run-worn-run gathering. And the Democratic Party finds itself in an unusual political moment. While some activists are enthusiastic about a senior stateswoman with a deep political resume, others express concern that the lack of a competitive primary may not serve the party's best interests. Progressives seem particularly restive as they seek to refocus the party's electoral agenda on issues of income insecurity and a less interventionist foreign policy. But it remains to be seen whether any other candidates will emerge from the shadow of Hillary Clinton's inevitability, even as President Obama sets the stage for just such a vigorous debate within the party. Today on The Exchange, we're delving into the Democrats. Let's hear from you. What do you think should be the Democratic Party's top issues in 2016? Who do you think should be the Democratic Party's nominee? Would you like to see President Obama take an active role in promoting the Democratic Party during the campaign? How do you think the New Hampshire primary will play out? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me today for the show. With me in studio is Dante Scala. Dante is Associate Professor of Political Science and a faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. Next fall, Dante will be teaching a free online course on the New Hampshire primary with UNH Professor Andy Smith. And you can find information about that course on our website. And joining me from Washington, D.C. is Jose Del Real. Jose is a national political reporter for The Washington Post. And Jose, welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Gentlemen, before we get into the horse race aspect of the presidential primary field for Democrats, let's talk a little bit about where the party is generally. And Dante, let me start with you. How strong is the Democratic Party at the moment?
I think the answer is not very. Barack Obama's presidential legacy will be complicated, and historians will take a long time to figure it out. But right now, for the Democratic Party, I think Obama's legacy is at best mixed. Remember back to 2008, 2009, there were a lot of comparisons of Obama to FDR, that in the wake of the Great Recession, that Barack Obama's policies might bring about a new Democratic majority. But right now, in 2015, Republicans control both chambers of Congress. And in fact, in the House of Representatives, Republicans control as many seats as they have since World War II in that whole era. Republicans control a majority of governorships. Republicans control a majority of state legislative chambers, including here in New Hampshire. So there's not, you know, going into 2016, while there'll be a lot of talk about Democrats' advantage in a presidential election as opposed to midterms, overall, the state of the party is from the grassroots seats up is not great.
So they seem to do well in presidential elections, but it's kind of what's happening in between that should be the concern for them. Jose, let me put the same question to you. Where do you think the Democratic Party is right now?
Well, I think that we see a national Democratic Party that is really, really looking for a message that it can shepherd its candidate through into the presidency in 2016. You know, the nature of the 2014 midterm election made it so that various Democratic candidates around the country were running on different messages and also in large part running away from President Obama, who was deeply unpopular in a lot of the key states. We saw how that ended up. The Republican Party ended up taking control of the Senate. They now control two chambers of Congress. And that really does weigh heavily on national leaders in the Democratic Party who are desperately trying to figure out how to realign their party's messaging before the next presidential election really heats up.
And Dante, let me have your reaction, and then I want to ask you a follow-up question.
Yeah, I mean, in 2016, I mean, you look at political scientists are big on models and trying to model what might happen in 2016. And a couple things they look at is, one, the state of the economy, two, the state of the incumbent, and also whether – how long that party's been in power. Democrats – you know, Hillary Clinton, if she's the nominee, faces the problem that her party's been in control of the White House for two terms. And it's very difficult typically for the same party to get that third term because voters tend to think it's time for a change. Now, the economy's doing better, no doubt, but – it may need to do better still in order for Hillary Clinton to overcome that, one, it's time for a change perhaps feeling among voters, and two, a president who's a little more popular than he was, say, you know, 6 months, a year ago, but it's still not close to that, you know, 50% mark approval among voters. So there are some things that whoever the nominee of the Democratic Party is going to have to overcome.
Yeah. So, Dante, why does it seem like we have two different Democratic electorates, midterm versus general election? It really seems to be that's kind of a repeating pattern that we see in the election cycles.
Well, you've got two different electorates because you've got in presidential years, you have lower propensity voters, you know, including lower income minority voters who are less likely to turn out in those midterm elections than they are in presidential elections. And the same with, say, the youth vote, okay, 18 to 29-year-olds. So there's a difference between, you know, Democrats do tend to do better in those high turnout elections than lower turnout. But another problem is that Democrats are having problems not only with white working class voters. That's an old problem. A newer problem that's been pointed out by analysts such as John Judis is white middle class voters. And for all their upside among minority voters, female voters, professionals with postgraduate degrees, it's that problem among kind of white middle class voters with college degrees that the Democratic nominee is going to have to pay attention to in 2016.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a moment about the party's agenda and how they might shift it or change it in order to kind of change the demographics of their support. But Jose, your take real quick on the what seems to be dual electorates at the midterm and presidential elections.
Yeah, well, one of the big concerns that the Democratic Party is facing right now is how to hold on to the Obama coalition that elected the president in 2008 and then reelected him in 2012. It's unclear if any of the candidates, and we can talk about Hillary Clinton in a little bit, but it's unclear if any of the candidates are going to have the same pull among minority voters as the president had. And that's, you know, in addition to these other problems that Dante already outlined. But I do want to take a quick step back and talk about the economic messaging that the Democrats are struggling with.
Sure.
You know, the president in his 2014 State of the Union said that it was going to be a year of action, and he, you know, did sound something like a populist, and it did seem like it was going to be that the midterm election was going to be oriented around a series of middle class issues. That, you know, didn't end up being the case. Income inequality was not an enormous aspect of Democratic messaging leading to the midterms. So, you know, we've heard the Democrats say that they want to focus on income inequality, but we didn't see it pan out in the last election. And I think that they're really feeling it now, especially now that economic markers are showing that the economy is doing better. But Democrats, you know, may not end up getting the credit because of how they played their hand in the midterm elections.
And let's listen to President Obama talking a little bit about his middle-class economics during his 2015 State of the Union address.
So what does middle-class economics require in our time? First, middle-class economics means helping working families feel more secure in a world of constant change. That means helping folks afford childcare, college, health care, a home, retirement. And my budget will address each of these issues, lowering the taxes of working families and putting thousands of dollars back into their pockets each year.
That is President Obama during his 2015 State of the Union address. And Dante, I'd like to have your reaction to that, but you also just said something very interesting. Do you think that Democrats really need to worry about losing minority voters or the sort of non-white voters that have kind of been the kind of the bedrock of their support?
No, I don't think they need to worry about losing minority voters right now. I think it is a question about turnout. I think that's something to watch going forward among African-American voters. I mean, obviously, Barack Obama was a unique figure among African-American voters. Will Hillary Clinton be able to duplicate turnout among those voters? But it's still the case that African-Americans vote very predominantly Democratic. Same with Hispanics. And, you know, the question of immigration is bound to be significant, I think, in 2016, and that cuts both ways, cuts against Democrats among white working class voters, but certainly works in their favor among Hispanic voters. So I'm not so worried about that for Democrats, I would say. But it is an interesting question to look at in terms of, as Jose said, economic messaging. You know, the economy is doing better. And if it's doing better still in 2015 into 2016, then I think the worries about messaging go away. A really good economy takes care of the need for economic messaging because everyone feels better regardless of what the president or the presidential candidates say. But Clinton will have to grapple with the Obama legacy, I think something like what Al Gore had to do with Bill Clinton's legacy.
Yeah. Jose, your take on the economic message.
Yeah, I think that right now the question that is emerging, and not just on the Democratic side, by the way, also on the Republican side, is who is benefiting from this improved economy? Who have the gains gone to? You know, a few years ago, if Democrats had, you know, said all of these gains are going to the rich, Republicans would have very quickly called, you know, class warfare on them and accused them of inciting these conflicts between various social classes. Now on the Republican side, among their potential presidential candidates, you really hear them talking about income inequality that makes it seem as if they've been talking about this all along. It is a strategic pivot that will likely allow them to hit the president on his economic policy while courting these populist votes.
Mm-hmm. And Jose, we need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back to continue talking about the Democratic Party's political identity for 2016. So stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're delving into the Democrats. We're taking a look at the dynamics of the Democratic Party ahead of the 2016 elections. You can call in to us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. I have two guests with me today for the hour. Dante Scala is in studio. He's the Associate Professor of Political Science at UNH. And Jose Del Real is joining us from Washington. He's a national political reporter for The Washington Post. And gentlemen, we were talking about the economic agenda prior to the break, and I want to broaden out the discussion a little bit to talk about the party's agenda in general for 2016. We put up a question on the show's Facebook page to kind of get a response for what people were interested in. And Keith says he's interested in dealing with gun violence. Pete talks about ending the war on drugs and ending prohibition, which I assume means legalization of marijuana, but I'm not sure. And Steve and Will both talk about income inequality and the class warfare, according to Steve, being fought against the poor and working class. Dante, let me go to you first. Sir, what are kind of the big policy divisions within the party this time around?
Within the Democratic Party, I think there is – I mean, we often talk about Republicans being the party of the wealthy, looking out for the wealthy, and the Democrats being the party of the working class, looking out for the poor and less well off. But that overshadows the fact that there is real class division within the Democratic Party. And you saw that with Barack Obama, that he had this kind of unique coalition in the 2008 primaries of African-American voters and then some white voters, but they tend to be more upscale, more progressive. So you've got this coalition of Democrats that consists of, on the one hand, minority voters, but then also you've got people such as in New Hampshire who are postgraduate professionals. And that populist message that people keep bandying about as this kind of magical solution to some of the Democrats' problems, it runs against the problem that there's no particular reason to think that if you're a professional, well-educated Democratic voter, that that populist message is going to appeal to you. Or if you're a middle-class voter with a college degree, that that populist economic message is going to appeal to you. So there are some interesting kind of questions for Democrats and for Hillary Clinton to be thinking about in her messaging for 2016.
Jose, your take on kind of general divisions within the party going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think everything that Dante just said is right on. And I think the key point is that while, you know, gun violence and the war on drugs are potent conversation topics, the real division that we're seeing emerging right now, and, you know, this could change in a month, it could change in 2 months, but the primary differences right now within the Democratic Party have to do with economics, with the messaging behind the economic recovery, and with the idea that the middle class hasn't benefited from Obama's policies. Going forward, if there is a Democratic field at all, or if it's just Hillary Clinton, the question is going to be, you know, how do we pitch our economic policies from the last, you know, 8 years under Obama? How do we continue to pitch that in 2016 if middle class voters don't feel like they've benefited from these policies? How do we kind of correct that course?
Dante?
Yeah, I think Jose's point is important about the economic legacy of President Obama. I mean, if you're, a wealthy two-degree family, working family, say in Bow, New Hampshire, and you tend to vote Democratic and you and your spouse both have professional degrees and money in the stock market and mutual funds, you've done very well during the Obama years. But if you're, say, a middle-class, working-class person where most of your money was invested in your house and that was your primary source of wealth, you look back on the Obama years and say, I'm not better off than I was in the aftermath of the Great Recession. You know, my real wages haven't gone up in half a decade. This has been a lost decade for me. And that, you know, that economic situation of those two different groups of people is something that, you know, the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton are going to have to grapple with. You know, again, how do you say the economy's growing if real wages are stagnant? Now, maybe that will change over the next year, which, again, would overcome any kind of concerns about messaging. But as long as it doesn't, it's a problem. And Republicans will – and it's also a problem – for Democrats, you know, the problem with the populist message is people recognize inequality as a problem, but the very people that are being affected by inequality aren't convinced that government is the solution to that problem.
Right. Clearly, economic messaging, I think, is going to be a central issue. A couple other issues that obviously usually play into elections and I think will this time as well. Foreign policy and also health care. Jose, let's talk a little bit about foreign policy. I mean, there certainly has been a push within the party for a less interventionist foreign policy, yet, you know, Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and she had to deal with her Iraq war vote when she ran the last time. Where do you see the Democrats on foreign policy? And we can even be more specific and talk about ISIS or the Islamic State, which seems to be the threat that everyone's focused on right now.
Well, you know, this is the right away the problem that you run into when you only have one candidate in the Democratic field. That conversation won't matter unless somebody steps in and actually challenges Hillary Clinton's record as Secretary of State or challenges what has generally been a more hawkish approach to foreign policy than many Democrats are comfortable with. She is also going to really struggle to distinguish herself from President Obama's foreign policy approach, given that she was his Secretary of State.
Right. Dante, go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off, Jose. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think the real conversation that you're going to have about foreign policy is going to be between Democrats and Republicans, not within the Democratic Party.
Right. Dante, foreign policy.
Yeah, I think Jose's right on that. In the sense that I think Hillary Clinton ultimately winds up when she establishes her foreign policy stances for 2016, taking a few steps to the right of Barack Obama and taking a centrist position that probably will resemble, you know, what Jeanne Shaheen did last year in her 2014 run versus Scott Brown. I remember how Scott Brown was really amping up foreign policy, talking about ISIS, for example, threats to America and so forth. And Shaheen had to respond to that in a way that sounded not at all non-interventionist, but hawkish, but maybe mildly hawkish versus Scott Brown's very hawkish. And I think that's where you're going to find Hillary Clinton. You're not going to find Hillary Clinton defending Barack Obama's foreign policy loudly in 2016 unless you see some really significant changes in places like the Middle East and in situations like ISIS.
Mm-hmm. And Jose, what about Obamacare? Do Democrats just kind of line up behind it, or are there going to be attempts to maybe put a little daylight on some aspects of it?
You know, I think that the conversation on Obamacare has changed so much just in the last 3 months, just since the midterms. Even leading to the midterms, it had kind of lost some of the potency. I think right now, as far as the Affordable Care Act goes, we're kind of in a wait-and-see period. Democrats are waiting and seeing how the law pans out, if it's going to work. There's also a Supreme Court case, obviously, hanging over the Affordable Care Act. And Republicans, you know, the ones that aren't involved in the Supreme Court case, are also waiting to see how effective the law actually is. You know, it might pop up in the 2016 election. You know, a candidate like Ted Cruz has forged his political identity against the Affordable Care Act. That, you know, likely won't go away. But I don't think that it's as a politically potent topic as it has been in the last few years.
Dante, losing steam as an issue?
As a particular issue, I think it is. But as a general one, no. And let me explain. I think you're going to hear Republican primary contenders certainly talking about replacing Obamacare with something more market-oriented to various degrees. But to the extent that It's 2016 is a question about the size and scope of the government and what's appropriate size and scope. That's where I think, you know, Obamacare and so forth gets into the equation, that Republicans would be wise to run on bread and butter issues for them, both in New Hampshire and in the nation, which is all about what's the appropriate size and scope of the national government. Kelly Ayotte did that very well in 2010, and I suspect she'll do the same against whoever her Democratic opponent is in 2016.
I want to tell our listeners we're talking about the Democratic Party and the 2016 presidential race today. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, and tell us, who do you think should be the Democratic Party's nominee for president? And which issues are most important to you? And would you like to see President Obama take an active role in the 2016 Democratic Party campaign? I'm joined today by Dante Scala, Associate Professor, Political Science at UNH, and Jose Del Real, National Political Reporter for The Washington Post. And gentlemen, let's shift gears now and talk a little bit more specifically about the horse race or the lack of a horse race. And Jose, let me start with you. Is Hillary Clinton really inevitable?
You know, this question I get a lot. The thing is, Hillary Clinton was inevitable in 2007 and 2008. And guess what? She didn't become the president. So I think political reporters are cautious of using the E word. And I think Hillary Clinton's allies are even more cautious. You know, they're actually figuring out a way to downplay the idea of inevitability because, it could shoot her in the foot again.
Yeah, let's take a listen to Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday in Silicon Valley about the likelihood that she's going to run for president.
All in good time is sort of my response because, you know, there's a lot to think about. I have to tell you, I don't know how many of you are list makers, you know, and so I have a very long list. I'm going down it. I'm very committed to go down it, but I haven't checked off the last couple of things here.
That's Hillary Clinton speaking yesterday in Silicon Valley about whether or not she's going to run for president. And Dante, let me get your response to the inevitability issue.
Hillary Clinton is 100% more inevitable than she was in 2008. In 2008, you had a formidable top tier of candidates running against Hillary Clinton. Not only Barack Obama, who turned out to be a pretty fair national politician, but also John Edwards, who had finished second in 2004, obviously was very good in Iowa. Now, you know, this was before all his personal troubles came out and so forth. So it was clear that Clinton was, you know, in retrospect, that Clinton had a real dogfight in 2008. There's nothing resembling that top tier of talent in 2016 going forward. I mean, you look at polling, I mean, she's in a position that's much more like the position that Al Gore was in back in 2000. Now, did Al Gore face a primary contender? Yeah, he did, Bill Bradley. Did Bill Bradley win a single primary in 2000? No. No, he didn't. And I suspect the same thing will happen. But there's no reason. I mean, sure, Hillary Clinton's people are playing down the candidacy. Why should she poke her head out and become a candidate and immediately face all sorts of not only media scrutiny, but also attacks from Republicans? Let Republicans fight amongst themselves for a while she builds an organization quietly. And as long as there's no serious contender on the Democratic side, there's no rush at all to get out there.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, let's go to the Jose, do you want to let's take a phone call and then we'll come back to that in a moment. Let's welcome Jonathan from Manchester. Jonathan, welcome to the Exchange.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead, please.
My first observation is I know that recently Hillary Clinton has sat down in private meetings with Elizabeth Warren. The grassroots there is a lot of buzz on, of course, Warren and even someone like a Bernie Sanders to come out and maybe not even necessarily ultimately thinking they can win, but that it can drive the conversation to the root and to the grassroots. And I think that's where the power of the party is going to be found. And it's going to be a struggle between that and the mainstream Democrats like Wendy Wasserman Schultz, who is really a super centrist and as Wall Street as any Republican, which a good portion of the Democrats are. That's the first thing. But I think that the one thing Hillary will have for advantage when she goes through the whole gauntlet, because she's not loved by everybody on every front, but she will look great compared to whoever the Republicans end up putting up there. You can't run against a Bush who seems like the most moderate because his family has baggage. Particularly, you're talking about war front and everything else like that. He makes Hillary look like a peacemaker compared to the hot that she is.
And Jonathan, thank you for that call. Let's go to Jose. Jose, your response to Jonathan's comments.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Jonathan is right on when he's talking about Elizabeth Warren having an influence on the debate. You know, the Ready for Warren group, I wrote a story the other day, just a quick blog post, when the headline was Warren, the draft Warren campaign can't stop and won't stop. And, you know, part of it is that they, you know, they're very excited by her. They're very excited by her message. And she has proven to be a very effective person in delivering that message. But she, you know, she says that she is not running for president. She has given no indication that she is running. And she hasn't started, you know, developing her own staff on the ground in key early voting states. So that signals that she actually means it when she says she's not running. What she does have the power to do is to really, really influence the conversation and to really influence the sorts of positions that Hillary Clinton is going to take and the questions that the party is going to be asking Hillary Clinton.
And let's listen to an advertisement from the Ready for Warren organization.
We are ready for Warren. We think it's time to elect a leader who is fearless, honest, and progressive. Someone who will fight for all of us, not just the 1%. Someone like Elizabeth Warren.
Dante, your reaction?
I mean, it's always the case every 4 years. There's a lot of pent-up energy on the progressive left. And right now, that pent-up energy has nowhere to go but to Elizabeth Warren or, say, to Bernie Sanders. But we know from experience that, I mean, there's a reason why Elizabeth Warren's sitting on the sidelines. I mean, maybe she just doesn't want to be president. But also, it's the case that progressive Democratic candidates typically fall far short of winning the Democratic nomination. And Barack Obama was the exception to that rule for reasons very particular to his candidacy. So I agree with Jose, though, that Hillary Clinton will adopt some of Elizabeth Warren's rhetoric, if not her particular policies. She'd be foolish not to offer an argument that addresses middle class and working class voters' economic insecurity and inability to get ahead during the Obama economy.
Go ahead, Jose.
Yeah, and I think that is really intersecting with Hillary Clinton's feminism. You know, the speech that she gave yesterday in Silicon Valley, it was to a women's tech conference. The speech that she gave was all about the need to expand economic opportunities for women as a means of expanding the economy for everybody in the United States and in the world. You see this kind of, you know, populist, very middle class and working class rhetoric working its way into Hillary Clinton's appeal to women, which was, you know, a topic that she actually shied away from in 2008. So, you know, this question is kind of all pervasive right now, the way in which her economic messaging is going to play out.
We need to take one more quick break. When we get back, there'll be more on the developments in the Democratic Party in advance of the 2016 presidential primary. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on The Exchange, a look at the growing controversy around adjunct professors. Send us an email before the show at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Twitter or Facebook. But today we're taking a look at the National Democratic Party, and you can join us by calling 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or emailing us at exchange@nhpr.org. I have with me today Dante Scala in studio, associate professor at UNH, and Jose Del Real, a national political reporter for The Washington Post. And Dante, you wanted to jump in real quickly before the break.
Yeah, I think Jose puts his finger on it when he talks about Hillary Clinton going to Silicon Valley and talking about expanding opportunity for women. And the tension in the Democratic Party is, you know, a lot of the wealth of the party comes from places like the Silicon Valley, where you've got, you know, lots of young entrepreneurs amassing great amounts of wealth in the tech economy and so forth. You know, the question is, yeah, they're all for expanding opportunity for women, but they're, I suspect, not especially interested in a populist message from Elizabeth Warren, because in fact, if the Silicon Valley executives are not part of the 1%, I would bet on them being part of the 5% or the 10%. And they don't want to hear a message that is so overtly populist, spread the wealth, that you get from, you know, an Elizabeth Warren supporter, I suspect.
Gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. Kathleen from Peterborough is joining us. Kathleen, welcome to The Exchange.
Well, thank you, Dean Silliotis. I appreciate you taking my call. I had a two-part comment. One is, with the big machine focusing right on Hillary and kind of everybody else is pushed out to the wayside, I think we're making a mistake looking at the next election that way. And the second part of my comment is a lot of talk about the middle class and the working class, but we have a big bank of seniors, the retirees, who have living on an average of $15,000 a year Social Security checks, and with the talk in Washington about cutting Social Security, Medicare, that whole piece, and it comes from not having earned a livable wage through the working years. So that big bank of voters, so looking at one candidate essentially and not talking about this bank of retiree voters and where their say comes in.
Jose, your reaction to Kathleen. And Kathleen, thank you for that call.
Kathleen, let me first speak to your point about the machine focusing on Hillary Clinton. You know, it is true that national Republican groups, I think, you know, specifically of America Rising, which is an opposition research organization, they're really, you know, digging into as much of Hillary Clinton's past as they possibly can. The thing is, she's been, a public figure for decades. There are questions as to, you know, what is even going to come out at this point. You know, that said, she her tenure as Secretary of State, the Clinton Foundation's fundraising practices, et cetera, are already becoming issues that Republicans are focusing on and kind of bringing out into the open. But, you know, I think it's true that we're maybe not focusing enough on a few of the other potential top Democratic contenders, because inevitably they – even if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, she's going to have to find a vice presidential running mate. She's going to have to fill her cabinet if she wins. So, you know, there are other people to be focusing on. Hillary Clinton isn't the only target that we should be aiming at.
Dante.
And, you know, there are two schools of thought about competitive primaries. One is that competitive primaries fracture the party that's having them, and it prevents the party from gelling behind the winner for the general election. And that was a big argument you heard in June of 2008, that there were all these Hillary voters who were upset and were going to go vote for John McCain over Barack Obama. But I think actually the second school of thought is more on target, and which is – and this gets to Kathleen's point – is that primaries are good for the party because it generates enthusiasm. And I think primary contests would be good for Hillary Clinton, frankly, to get the rust off. We saw how poorly Barack Obama did in his first debate against Mitt Romney in 2012. And arguably, it was because he was rusty and he hadn't been challenged for a very long time. Hillary Clinton hasn't run for competitive office now for 7 years, going on eight. I would tend to think Democrats would like to see her get in at least some sparring rounds before going up against the Republican nominee in, say, October of 2016.
Yeah, Dante, interesting you mentioned competitive primaries. Christopher from Manchester emailed us, and he says, the left seems intent on hijacking the primary away from Hillary. Will the Democratic true believers start to make the same mistakes the Republican right has made for several years by demanding ideological purity? And let's listen to New Hampshire Democratic Party Chairman Raymond Buckley talking with Chris Matthews about this issue of debates in a competitive primary in a recent interview.
As party chair, do you want to see debates in the New Hampshire primary if there are multiple candidates?
If they're legitimate candidates, sure. And I would be, I would assume that she would do that. I can't imagine if they're legitimate opponents.
Why are you so hesitant to serve, since there have always been debates in these elections? I grew up with them. There have always been debates. They're the best thing in television. You get a good debate in New Hampshire. Obama makes a stupid remark like she's likable enough, and it turns things around. Reagan says, give me that mic. I paid for it. Don't you want the theater of it at least?
And that's Chris Matthews interviewing New Hampshire Democratic Party Chairman Ray Buckley. Jose, let me hear your thoughts about competitiveness, and then we have more callers to speak with.
Well, first I'll say that if there isn't a set of debates on the Democratic side, I'll be really disappointed, because I do love the theater of it. It is a lot of fun. But more than that, Dante's point about getting the rust off for Hillary Clinton, you know, is right on the money. If Hillary Clinton goes into an October, you know, set of debates without having debated anybody else, without having been asked, you know, very, very aggressive questions by an opponent, how do you expect her to do well in that situation, particularly somebody like Hillary Clinton, who has such high stature in this country that the people around her are also not likely to push back strongly against her. So, you know, I think that if I were a Democratic voter, I would certainly be very hesitant or very nervous about the possibility of a non-competitive primary.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And Tanya is joining us from Bedford. Tanya, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, thank you for having me. excuse me. As a person who was born and raised in Massachusetts, Senator Kennedy was my senator, well, since before I was born. And I really see Elizabeth Warren, and I hope that she sees herself as the next great liberal lion of the Senate. And if she could have a career as, you know, half as long as Senator Kennedy's and as productive, she would be charting the legislative course for this country for a really long time. I mean, I just think that there are some things that are more important than probably being president.
So thank you for that call, Tanya. Dante, is this one of those concerns where you want to keep someone like Elizabeth Warren in the Senate if you're a Democrat, maybe not even be a cabinet official necessarily?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, why be a cabinet official when you could be Ted Kennedy or possibly have that sort of career? Yeah, Tanya's right on the money in terms of, I mean, we tend to look at the presidency, you know, we think that Elizabeth Warren, if only she were president, could implement all these populist policies. But the day that, I mean, I would, in the very unlikely event of a Elizabeth Warren presidency, it's almost a lock that progressives would be just as disappointed in, say, 2020 with Elizabeth Warren as they have been at times with Barack Obama. And that's not Obama's fault necessarily or Warren's fault. It's just that the presidency is built with a lot of restraints. And the president doesn't have all that much power in the American system of checks and balances. So in some ways, I could see Elizabeth Warren. I think she's trying to play it both ways. She refuses to say, you know, she's been fairly definitive, but refuses to say absolutely that she won't run because she gets her agenda out there. But arguably, she might be in a better perch in the Senate to get things done than she would be as a President Warren.
Now, speaking of senators, we haven't talked much this hour about Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He's been very active, of all the candidates, perhaps the most potentially active, giving speeches in New Hampshire. Let's listen to Bernie Sanders speaking to ABC News about the issues facing the American working class.
The working class of this country, the middle class of this country, are facing enormous problems. We are going to end up, and I use these words, Jeff, advisedly, as an oligarchic form of society in which a handful of billionaire families control not only the economy of this country, but because of this disastrous Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, they control the political life of this country. I will do everything I can to prevent that from happening.
And that's Bernie Sanders speaking to Jeff Zeleny of ABC News about issues facing the American working class. And Jose, what do you make of Bernie Sanders and his interest in the presidency at this point in his career?
You know, a few of my colleagues and I actually spoke with Senator Sanders maybe a month back. And, you know, we were asking him, do you think that you are a viable presidential candidate? Do you think that you can actually develop the national infrastructure that you would need to become the president of the United States? And he didn't answer us directly, obviously. But, you know, what he told us was that he's most interested right now in getting his idea out and kind of test driving these ideas, like what we just heard in the clip, to see if the message sticks, to see if he could maybe build a viable campaign. You know, it's maybe too early to count him out, but, you know, he does, you know, describe himself as a socialist, and that's maybe going to make a general election pretty difficult for him to win.
Dante, briefly, your thoughts on Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I mean, New Hampshire and Iowa can be the biggest political megaphones in America, especially in the year before the presidential primaries and caucuses. So on both sides of the fence, we see people who don't look like viable candidates for the presidency who come up and they get media attention and they get their ideas out there. And I take Sanders at his word. He's trying to get the ideas out there to influence the debate. But again, you take mainstream Democratic voters, I don't think they care all that much about Citizens United. At least, you know, they would be very happy with a Hillary super PAC to counteract the Republican super PACs. They may not be thrilled with money in politics, but I'm hard pressed to see someone winning a nomination based on opposition to money in politics.
And thanks to Frank in Bedford as well for emailing us about Bernie Sanders. Gentlemen, let's talk a little bit more about where we go from here in terms of how the primary plays out. Jose, let me start with you.
You know, I really think that just based on the shadow campaign that Hillary Clinton is running, you know, you do see her putting in place a core staff of allies and former Obama campaigners who campaign staffers who are going to start focusing on building a national campaign. You know, presidential races are logistically quite complicated. They are very sophisticated operations. Nobody else is matching that right now. And she's going to have a head start if and when she announces that she's running. But I think, you know, looking at Senator Warren, looking at Senator Sanders, the reality is that there is a real desire on the left to have conversations about big ideas. And Hillary Clinton's aware of that. You see her speaking about her particular brand of feminism, about her particular brand of middle-class economics. And you see the beginning of these debates. So even if there isn't a competitive primary, there will be, I think, a primary of ideas. Yeah.
Dante, before I get your final thoughts, let's grab one more call. Ellen from Newmarket is joining us. Ellen, welcome to The Exchange. We got short on time, but we want to hear what you think.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me. So I'm so glad that you guys just mentioned super PACs and money in politics. And I heard someone say that voters don't care about money in politics. And I just want to say that I think whatever candidate it is going to be is going to have to be super strong and super vocal and specific on the issue of money in politics. Because here in New Hampshire, and I don't know if this person who made the comment was aware, but we just had a huge walk where 500 people walked across the entire state in the snow and the ice to call for an end to money in politics, the corrupting influence that it has. We've had 56 towns officially ask their legislators to overturn Citizens United with a constitutional amendment. So this issue is gaining so much momentum. I think it's going to be the primary issue. It's certainly one that Democrats have championed more so than Republicans, but we really need a candidate who's going to be very, very vocal on the issue and very strong and specific. And, you know, so far I haven't seen that being a big issue, but it's going to be, I think, one of the main issues, if not the main issue, by the time we have the election.
And Ellen, thank you for that call. Dante, your thoughts on campaign finance and kind of more generally where we go from here?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've read the reports about the marches and so forth. I think if Ellen is looking to Hillary Clinton for that, and I'm not saying she is, I think she's going to be disappointed. I think the Democratic Party made to cry money in politics, but they've been taking advantage of this, the new devices such as super PACs as much as they've been able – maybe not as much as the Republicans, but certainly significantly. And the Democrats are going to be faced with the need to raise as much money as possible, and there's a lot of chagrin about that. But Democrats aren't going to nominate someone who's going to unilaterally disarm. And again, it's one thing to have a march. It's another thing to see voters put campaign finance at the top of their agenda compared to issues such as the economy.
Jose, we got about 45 seconds left, so we can get your thoughts on campaign finance as well.
Yeah, I unfortunately agree that any movement on campaign finance is going to be very difficult. Both sides accuse the other side of you know, raising these crazy amounts of money. So their justification for it is that they're just trying to remain competitive so that they can affect a broader ideological turn in the country. It's difficult to get a candidate to say no to big money because it turns out that they rely on that money a lot of the time to build these sophisticated campaigns on the ground.
And we should mention that we actually haven't talked about it today, but Vice President Joe Biden is in town giving a talk. He's thinking about a run. We'll see what he decides down the road as well. But we are unfortunately out of time. I know we're going to be watching all of this very closely as the Democratic field shapes up in the coming months. I'd like to thank both of my guests for joining us this morning. Jose, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you for having me.
That's Jose Del Real, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Jose joined us from Washington, D.C. And Dante, it's always great to see you.
Good to see you too, Dean.
That's Dante Scala, associate professor of political science and faculty fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. Dante and his colleague Andy Smith are going to be teaching a free, I believe, national online course on the New Hampshire primary starting in October. 6 weeks, you can go. You can register now. Look for information on our website. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our intern is Dylan Morrill. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.